is the Freedom Fiends, weekend edition, broadcasting from the Wormabago Mobile Studio in the depths of Bootleg Bayou, where the swamp meets the sea and revenuers dare not tread, where the swamp's alive with a thousand eyes, and none of them belong to the NSA. The Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments, and you can learn more about that at BIPCOT.org. That's BIPCOT.org. And my name is Ben Stone. With me, by way of Fiend Phone, is Chandler St. Pierre. Chandler, how you doing, dude?
I'm doing awesome, Ben. It's good to be back with you on the Fiends. I love doing the weekend shows, you know.
Yeah.
My brain functions a little better in the daytime.
It is nice having you back on the show. You and I have a good flow together, I think.
Oh, yes.
So we're in the aftermath today of the interview that was played yesterday on Saturday with Lynn Ulbricht. And that it was really neat to talk to her. And so I wanted to start off, for the folks listening, Chandler and I have been looking at this this video that Cody Wilson put out in reference to Ross Ulbricht's conviction as the Dread Pirate Roberts with the Silk Road, and specifically referring to the double life sentence he was given for essentially running a website. I mean, even if you look through the can, we went through all this stuff in the show yesterday, and you can download that and listen to it for yourself. But putting aside all the fake charges that people say that he was charged with, but the government never did charge him with, putting aside all of that stuff, putting aside all the lies that the media put out about him, if you look at the actual charges that he was convicted for, and if you look at the actual sentences that he was given basically 2.5 life sentences for running a website, and that really is what it boils down to. Now, Cody, in this video, and we'll put a link in today's show notes to the video that Cody Wilson did on this, but Cody really says some, maybe for some people it might be shocking to hear Cody saying these things, but in a very real way, it's stuff that a lot of us have been saying for a while. You know, this thing is going to be pushed to the point of where it's going to become extreme. And when the government comes along and pushes something to the extreme, then it's there. I mean, they've already set they have set the floor as to where, you know, what the bottom level of this struggle is going to be. And everything that happens, you know, after that is going to be done on that floor. So they have already set the ground rules. The way the judge said it, the judge in the case said that she was sending a message. And Cody translated that for himself, and he says in this video, he says, no, this is not a message, this is an invitation. And I will take that a little bit further, and I will say this is not an invitation, this is a mandate. When she gave Ross a double life sentence plus, she set up a mandate upon all of the rest of us, all of us Dread Pirate Robertses that are out there, all around the world, in every country. This mandate now says the game has changed and it is far more serious than it has ever been before. But we cannot back down. We will not back down. It's not even a matter of will. It's not even like, I don't want to go into this fight. That's beside the point. The fight is upon us and we will fight it. We will do whatever has to be done. And they have already set the groundwork for this. So, I don't know. I'm already taking this a little bit more radical. I mean, Chandler, I meant to go this radical at some point. You know, I have notes and stuff, but instead of building up to it, I just jumped right into the fray. But I'm a tear the Band-Aid off kind of a guy. When I go swimming, I don't go and put my toe in the water and get, acclimated to the temperature of the water. I'm a dive in kind of a guy. What's your thoughts on all
that?
Yeah,
jump right off that cliff into the water. About an emotional issue for those of us who value freedom. One of the things that struck me, right, is whenever you listen to government-controlled media, which I try not to do anymore, but you always hear politicians saying that America is this amazing country where we value innovation and we foster it and encourage this innovation. Well, that's a load of crap, because Ross was an innovator. He created a website that catered to unconventional needs, and he did it in an ethical manner. You know, it put aside the spin that the media will put out there, you know, like there's child pornography and hitmen and all that crap. I mean, when you put aside that, he really did try to apply the non-aggression principle in his administration of this. And it was ready. It didn't serve. So what did they do? Do they value it? No. They crush it. They crush the man that they deemed responsible for it to send that message, which, like you said and like Cody said, I think it's an invitation. I can't wait. I know all our brothers, I think they've been rather quiet about this issue. When those cats are quiet about an issue, it doesn't bode well for the people that they're looking at. So I think that there's going to be a lot of behind the scenes, I don't even want to say con. People value freedom, and I don't think that they're just going to sit down and take this. I mean, God bless Lynn, you know, who's this? She doesn't care that the government doesn't like what she has to say. She doesn't care what's to suit their agenda. She's out there fighting for us. So, yeah, I don't know. I think we really need to join that fight in whatever capacity we can. Like, I mean, I'm a tech guy, but I know nothing about software and the internet. Like, you know, Google's my best friend when it comes to that stuff. I'm more of a hardware guy. But I'm sure there's something I can do, right? And there's thousands of people out there that know how to run websites and know how software works, you know how to do encryption. You know, if everyone starts banding together or acting as individuals, it doesn't even matter, and putting these alternative techniques out there, I think they're going to have a hard time keeping up. They're going to have a hard time shutting everyone down, right? You know, like, I mean, take Derek Slopey. He created FiendPhone. I won't say it's a simple little program. It's an awesome little program. And there's a million Derricks out there that believe in liberty. You know, so I think those judges' words, you know, it's just an invitation. It's a provocation for us to act.
You know, and it's a typical government misunderstanding of how economics work, too. If you think about, let's go with any other prohibition. Let's kind of take it in that direction a little bit. Back when there was, let's even go back before that. I'm talking in circles here, but if you go all the way back into medieval England, medieval Europe, and in France and in Belgium, there was wine production was a big deal. The transportation and of wine from France to Belgium was it was a market, and they there was a big market in the transportation of wine from France to Belgium. And of course, as the government started to grow, they saw something happening that they wanted to get a piece of. I mean, they're just like the mafia. They're like any other crime gang. They see something happening. If they can't control it, they want a piece of it. If they can't get a piece of it, then they want to shut it down altogether. So there was this growing wine market of sending wine from France into Belgium. And so the government started taxing it. They couldn't stop it. They couldn't control it, but they could tax it. And so they taxed it. How are you going to tax wine? Well, you tax it by the barrel. So what was the response to this? Well, the market responds when the government tries to regulate something and get a cut of it. The government, the market responds by adjusting the product or adjusting the procedure. So it started creating a black market between France and Belgium. And in addition to the black market that it started creating, it started causing people in France to essentially concentrate the wine to make it stronger. And thus we have the invention of brandy. Brandy is literally burned wine. That's what the word translates into. So you have now you have a barrel that is far more has far higher concentration of alcohol And the government couldn't keep up with this change. So it's still taxing the barrel like it's a barrel of wine, because technically it is a barrel of wine, but now it's concentrated and it's brandy. So if you have this mentality to say, well, we'll use the tax law to regulate people's behavior, we'll tax the sin, we'll tax the wine, and we'll make people not want it. No, you didn't. All you did was guarantee that it's a more potent product than it was before. And so this is what actually happened with wine and why there is brandy. Now, the same thing happened in the United States with prohibition of alcohol. The government decides to crack down on it. And the government beer was widely, there were beer breweries in pretty much every single city, and fresh beer was made on a daily basis and delivered from the breweries right to the bars all around towns all over America. And so then prohibition comes in, the government decides it's going to shut this terrible sinful production of beer down, and they come in and they start cracking down on it. Well, the demand is still there. The market is going to provide for the demand of the beer. And so what does it do instead? Well, if you're going to be thrown in jail for carrying a keg of beer, or you're going to be thrown in jail for carrying, you know, a few bottles of rum, then guess what? You carry the rum, because you can make more off the rum than you can off of the beer. So the prohibition of beer, prohibition of alcohol, created a demand for a much stronger product. And that's why almost all beer production ceased during prohibition. Because why would you make beer for a few pennies when you can make hard alcohol, or you can import it for dollars? And so the prohibition actually created an appetite for harder alcohol in the United States. And this is a well-documented thing. Folks at the Mises Institute have talked about this extensively. The prohibition of alcohol gave the American people a taste for hard liquor. And it stunned the beer industry. It didn't really start to recover until the 1980s. Well, the same thing happens with other types of recreational drugs, because that's all beer is a recreational drug, or wine, or whatever. When we get back, I talked us right into a break there. When we get back, we'll go into this a little bit more and talk about the repercussions of all this. Stick with us, folks. We'll be right back.
Worms.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends. My fellow sheep, election season is upon us. Are you one of the 12% of Americans who still approves of our government? Then we need your help to force the other 88% into compliance. Our democracy depends on it. We're an organization called Citizens Against Too Much Unfettered Freedom, or CATMUF. CATMUF is a bipartisan flock of sheep whose goal is expanding government until nothing else remains, because the government is here to help you. How can you help CATMUF help you? By only voting for candidates dedicated to expanding government. It's easy. You don't need to study the issues. No matter what a politician says when running for office, they're all dedicated to expanding government. And make sure you tell all your friends and family to vote for more government. Here at CATMUF, we don't care if you vote Democrat or Republican, as long as you vote for candidates committed to growing our federal family. CATMUF. Because folks just aren't smart enough to handle real freedom.
So, Chandler, before the break, we were talking about, or I was ranting about how government prohibitions and government taxations and government attempts to, you know, force people to not buy something through raising taxes on it or any excuse that they can use. Really, all it does is create a more potent product. You know, because the supply, the demand is there, and so the supply is going to find a way. It's kind of like, if you can imagine supply and demand, like, demand is like the ocean, and all water in the world...
Water takes the path of least resistance, right?
Exactly, yeah. All water seeks its way back to the ocean, even if it has to penetrate solid rock in its path to try to get back to the ocean. And it's gravity. I mean, that's the natural force of things that work. And markets are exactly like that. When there is a demand for something, the product will find a way to supply that demand. So you can't punish the supplier or tax the supplier or regulate the supplier and ever hope to stop the flow. All you can do is force it to take other paths. And what Cody was saying in that video is that when you introduce violence into this process and you make it so that honest people and peaceful people are not allowed or cannot function in that market to supply that product, then you are creating a situation where the government forces there to be a violent response to this. Because one way or the other, the water's going to make it to the sea. And whatever you do to get in the way, that's why a flood takes place. That's why you have a flash flood that wipes out half of a town, or that's why you have such destruction when flood water gets out of control, because something was trying to hold it back and it's not going to be held back. And the market is exactly like that.
The spice must flow.
Yeah. You know, and people on the internet know that reference, but that is exactly what that was.
Or as Michael likes that
book. Yeah. But that's the truth. I mean, that's how the market works. You just can't stop it like that.
Well, we all know that individuals in government have a poor understanding of economics anyway. I mean, they subscribe to that whole Keynesian garbage. But I find it interesting. They often try to legislate from a moral perspective when they're the most immoral people in the world. And even if they were, like, quote-unquote, moral individuals, how well has legislating for morality worked throughout history, right? I mean, prostitution is the oldest profession in the world, and it survived up into this day, despite, you know, government's best attempts at quashing it. You know, whether you... is besides the point. The point is that that's all to exist. So they're kind of naive to assume that they can just legislate these new...
Yeah, and the judge in that case with Ross, saying that this is sending a message and essentially threatening everybody that if you set up a website like this, this is what's going to happen. But, you know, I've referenced it to like stomping on one hornet. When you find a hornet's nest and you decide, you know, okay, I'm going to eradicate these hornets by stomping on this one hornet. Now, all you're really going to do, assuming you're successful in stomping on that one hornet, all you're really going to do is loose all the rest of the hornets to fill, you know, to do what that one hornet was trying to do. So if that hornet's trying to keep you away from the nest, and you think that by stomping that one hornet, you're going to then have access to the nest. No, you know, it's like anything else like that. You're just releasing a swarm upon yourself. And this is what happens. You know, the judge, maybe she was honest when she thought or when she said that she's going to slap this thing down and, you know, stop it from ever happening again. Maybe the judge is really that deeply stupid and ignorant of economics and ignorant of how things in life work. It's a possibility. On the other hand, you know, I kind of made this argument when Lynn was on.
I think it's desperation.
I think it is desperation, absolutely. You know, I think she actually investigated Ross's writings. She said she did about, you know, anarcho-capitalism and so forth. And I think she recognizes that if Ross's greater philosophy is adopted, that parasites like her will not have a job. And I think that's the thing that scares her. I don't think it has anything to do with drugs or the drug market or Silk Road. I think it's everything to do with that judge knowing that if Ross's philosophy is adopted, the parasites of the world will have nothing. They will have no place to feed. And that's all she is.
They're doomed. Yep. Worms.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
Hey, this is Nathan Explosion from Death Clock, and you're listening to Freedom Fiends on the radio. worms.
Meow.
So before the break, we were talking. Oh, I wanted to make one more point. I was before the break. We were talking about, or at least I was rambling on about how wine taxation and restrictions caused the market to invent brandy. You know, a higher alcohol concentration than wine, and the alcohol prohibition in the U.S. Sort of killed the beer industry, but it created a hard liquor industry and made, you know, the concentration of alcohol much higher, and therefore the addiction rates were much higher and everything. Well, we saw the same thing happen in the so-called drug war. You know, marijuana was extremely common in the 60s and 70s. In the 70s, the markets for hard drugs was there, but it was nothing really all that big. Everything was about marijuana in the 70s. I remember I was there. And in the early 80s, there was this fake crisis that was, I say, it was brought about by a couple really popular Hollywood movies and a TV show that was all about chasing down the coke dealers. And the public demanded, you know, something be done about this drug craze that was going on. Well, there was really no drug craze. There was a couple movies that were halfway decent and a TV show that was pretty goofy. But that kick-started the drug war, and cocaine was the big monster at the time. And so the fanatic chasing of the drug war in the early 80s and the fanatic chasing of the coke trade forced coke dealers to start shifting towards crack cocaine, or on the West Coast, we called it rock. And that was a big explosion in the 80s. If you were a Martian and you just dropped in out of nowhere in the 80s and just observed what was going on, you would have thought that everybody in America had giant chunks of crack cocaine shoved up their nose all the time. It was everywhere. And it was, but that wasn't really true. That was just what the media was saying. So the government cracks down on crack, and in doing so, they drove the manufacturers to shift, and they made it more and more and more hard, more expensive and harder to manufacture, transport, and trade in crack. And so what does the market do? The market shifts to something that's easier to make. Anybody can make it pretty much in their basement. And so now you've got a meth problem. And so they were going to crack down on all the mom-and-pop meth dealers in the United States. And we start having all these drug raids to get the mom-and-pop meth producers. So what happens? Well, the big cartels in Central and South America start producing meth. And every escalation that the government does and every addition of more violence and gunplay and arrests and crazy, crazy sentencing that the United States government pushes into their so-called drug war just kicks up the violence and kicks up the cost of doing business for people who are supplying the drugs. And like we were talking about, you can't stop water from reaching the sea. It'll go right through solid rock to do it. And the same thing goes with the market. If the market demands a recreational drug, laws and all the drug warriors you can hire and put on the border, none of that's going to do any good. All you're doing is increasing the cost and increasing the danger and driving the market to create more and more potent and smaller in smaller packages so that they can transport it. And that's the direction this is going. And that's why Ross was really doing a service, not only, I mean, to everybody really, because he was taking out the violent aspects of that and he was bringing in something that was never there before. Anyway, so that's hopefully that's the end of my rant there.
So wait a minute, Ben. Let me get this straight here. Are you telling me that the media lied to further the state's agenda?
Can you believe it?
I don't believe it.
Isn't that crazy?
No. It's nuts. No, I think that's an important aspect that needs to be reiterated several times, because the mainstream media doesn't talk about it, is that Ross did, as you said, take a lot of that violence out of the trafficking that went on the Silk Road. You know, he and the other admins always tried to govern that website through the non-aggression principle, you know?
And something you mentioned in the, I think it was in the first segment, and I got excited and just talked right over it, was that it was, the Silk Road was an innovation. And Cody mentioned that in his video, that the Silk Road was an innovation and, you know, Ross was an innovator. And as such, what that means is innovators are always a threat to government. Governments hate innovation. They fear innovation. And the reason that governments fear innovation is because innovation is true change. And governments can't keep up with change. They can't control change. They don't know where it's going to go. It's strange to them. Governments like, you know, static, little, controlled groups that don't think for themselves and just obey. That's what governments like. And so innovation scares their pants off.
They like that. Yeah, the governments prefer the centralized system. And systems like the ones that Ross established are a threat to their control. So, of course, they're going to quash it. And they're not going to address the fact that it was innovative. It was just dangerous. I mean, I remember one day, I knew what was going on with the Silk Road case, but my alarm clock went off one day, and for some strange reason, instead of the buzzer, it went off. And the first thing I heard was, oh yes, you know, the trial for Ross Ulbricht, the operator and founder of the Silk Road, where you could hire hitmen and buy dangerous drugs and pornography. I mean, that was the first thing I heard, you know, and I was like, really, really, you know, click. But I mean, think about it. The people who aren't as, I won't even say tech savvy, the people that aren't in some of the circles that we run in, that's probably the only information they got. So they're like, yeah. Yeah, we need to take these dangerous people that they're selling these things on the internet. We need to shut them down. We can't have that.
You know, and it's not just that. I mean, the governments are always afraid of innovation. They were terrified when electricity first started becoming a thing in the late 1800s. There were newspaper men that were talking about how this would cause mass casualties. There'd be thousands lying dead in the streets. And I mean, there was just all, and there were senators talking about how this had to be stopped before it got out of control. We can't allow this in people's homes. This is terrible. It's, you know, it's going to kill everybody. And you know, there were actual government people, congressmen, who were talking about outlawing electricity in people's houses because it was such a wildly dangerous idea. And the same thing happened, you know, when in the 1930s, when early computer technology started to come along, and the first thing government does is get control of the companies that are innovating in the computer industry, and by law won't let them sell to the public, won't let people experiment on their own with it, and governments, especially the United States government, but others, France and England and so forth, they held the computer technology in the clutches of governments all the way up into the 60s, you know, when it just got to the point of where they couldn't contain it anymore. That was the only way it got out of their hands, was crazy hackers in their mom's, you know, driveway and in their mom's garage making their own computers. That's how the thing got out of the government's hands, and they couldn't control it anymore. But they had controlled it since the 30s and just stifled innovation. The same thing is with rocketry. In 1920s, rocketry was like a new thing, and everybody was crazy about it, and all these, you know, inventors were making all kinds of headway. And then in the 1930s, governments figured out, ooh, that's scary and innovative. We have to get control of that. And they did. They outlawed individuals from, you know, rocketry experimentation. And it stayed that way for a couple generations, that individuals were not allowed to, you know, figure out ways to go to space and figure out ways to work with rocketry and so forth. Who knows where we would be today if the governments hadn't stifled innovation in the computer industry and in the rocketry industry.
Well, I can tell you, I was watching Back to the Future 2 the other day with my kid, and I'm pretty irked that the flying cars aren't here. It's 2015. You know, I'm kind of glad the fashion of the movie didn't take over, but I really wanted the flying car, you know, and I have to say, I blame government for that totally.
Yeah.
Their regulation of the auto industry has just totally screwed our chances for flying cars.
Yeah, they've got so, you know, the argument against radical libertarianism or anarcho-capitalism or anarchist, the argument is always, but who would build the roads? What about the roads? Blah, 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 the roads. But most people don't realize that by the government's investing, you know, gajillions into the highway system, you have created a static snapshot in time of technology. And today, our highways are still stuck in the technology of 1935. That's the design time frame that the highways froze when governments started socializing highways in the 20s and the 1930s. And so roads have not seen any significant innovation since the 1930s. So yeah, if there was no governments and if it was all left to the market, there may not be roads like we have today. But there would still be commerce. You would still, you know, Walmart wouldn't just close up its doors and go, well, I guess we have to close. We can't get any, you know, any coffee from Brazil, so we're going to have to close. No. Water flows. It finds its way, and the market would find a way.
Yeah, I think I was talking to a friend of mine, was it last Sunday, I think? Yeah. I had gone up to visit a friend, and we were talking, and he's kind of coming around to these radical anarcho-libertarian ideas, you know, and he still talks about, well, you know, we should tax the corporations and tax the rich. I mean, that's the big thing right now, right? You know, everyone loves Bernie Sanders because he wants to tax the rich and all that crap. But, you know, I spent a good 4 hours talking with him, not just about this stuff, but when we were talking about it, one of the points I tried to stress was that, you know, some of my arguments may seem extreme, right? They may seem like impossible that of the current system of government regulating and controlling and monopolizing these industries. I said, if you can remove yourself from that mindset, then you can begin to see that there would be alternatives in the absence of a government. And he actually, like, conceded that point to me, said, you know, it was a tough move for him, and we still didn't come to total agreement, but he kind of started to concede that point to me and saw how, yeah, you know, I mean, because he's a small business person, and yeah, I mean, it is possible. We just have to remove ourselves from this current system and this current state of mind to see the future.
And we'll be back with more right after this trip to the markets.
Worms.
Worms.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows. Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. Basic Handgun and Rifle with Jared Waltz.
First rule of being alive is you own yourself.
A groundbreaking approach to firearms and self-defense training. Beautifully filmed and easy to understand instructions make this one a must-have. Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. New DVD from Michael W. Dean, available on Amazon.
Your house is your property.
Here come the worms.
The worms crawl in, the worms crawl out. So right before the break, you had mentioned you were talking about you know, corporations and stuff. And I wanted to point out too that well, first off, you know, a lot of people are worried that corporations would, if the government weren't here to keep corporations in check, corporations would take over everything. They would be running everything, and you know, and then you stop and you think, well, who authorizes a corporation to exist? Who enforces the laws that say that a corporation can be a corporation and not, you know, some other legal form of a company, some other partnership or whatever? And of course, a corporation exists because of government regulation. Government regulation allows a corporation to exist. And corporations, of course, get anything they want from government, because the only thing you have to do to get government to do what you want it to do is hand them large amounts of cash. And the corporations have large amounts of cash. So the governments and the corporation, you know, if it weren't for the governments, first off, corporations couldn't be the giant monopolies that they are. They would still exist as companies some way or another, but they wouldn't be like they are now. And if government could control and limit corporations, and then it wouldn't be so influenced. I mean, if you think about the open door that swings between Monsanto and government and the big pharmaceutical companies and government, and between the military-industrial complex and government, the inbreeding between government and corporations is so rampant that this idea that if it weren't for government, you know, corporations would take over is really pretty silly on the surface. But then,
yeah, it's quite ridiculous.
One other aspect of that, because I've spent, you know, I have been both a small business owner, I've been a single employee business owner where I was my only employee. Then I've been a business owner where I had several employees, and then I've worked for giant corporations, Kerr McGee, General Electric, contracted to NASA, and so I've watched how these giant corporations and so forth work, and they are. On an individual basis, they're pretty amazing how they get stuff done. But on the larger scale, they are incredibly inefficient and incredibly as a corporation as a collective is extremely stupid and slow. They're slow to innovate. You know, when I worked for General Electric, and this is in the aerospace division in aircraft engines and General Electric. This was around 2000, 2001, 2002, and we were still using IBM software from the late 70s and early 80s. And that's what our main – we were switching over to Oracle at the time, but our main parts control software was from the early 80s. And it was so cumbersome and so backwards that it couldn't keep up with the demands that we had on it. And the reason why is because when a small company, when software changes and innovation takes place, if you're only changing out five or six computers, it's not that big of a deal. But if you've got a major corporation like General Electric, if you have to change out all of the computers in just the aircraft engines division, you're talking about a massive amount of money and a retraining problem where all of those employees now have to be retrained. So giant corporations have weaknesses built in that would naturally cause them to be limited in size, even if there were no governments around to limit them. So there's my rant for that one.
Well, I think it's ridiculous to think that governments limit the size of corporations anyway, right? They grant them their charters to become limited liability and legal fictions, otherwise known as corporations. They grant them that privilege, and then they interfere in the market to create monopolies for them. So if you say, oh, without the governments, corporations would take control, that's just ridiculous, because they enable them and they empower them. And it amazes me that people don't see that.
Yeah, all you really have to do is look at who the major donors are for every single candidate who's running for president in both parties currently. You know?
Right.
They all get their money from the big corporations, from the big bankers.
They hedge their bets. They'll back both sides just to make sure they get what they need.
Yeah, yeah. Even the rich Donald Trump has financially backed both Republicans and Democrats in other years before he was running.
Yeah.
Stick with us, folks. We're going to step away for the hour break, hear some news and other nasty stuff like that. But we'll be right back.
When you shop online, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you any extra, and the Fiends will get a little taste from Amazon, and Amazon will save you the danger of drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon sells pretty much everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed: The Road to Freedom. So get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com. Freedom, Foxtrot, Echo, November, Sierra.com.
This is the Freedom Fiends broadcasting from the back porch of Black Sheep. We feed your brain a steady diet of worms to help eat away at the indoctrination of the state. And the Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license, which allows reuse by anyone except who, Ben?
Except governments. No governments.
Nope, not here.
Got no place for them. Just don't need them. Don't want them.
Yeah, that's it right there.
Don't want their services. Don't. What do you say, Chandler, when people come up to you and say, well, the next time you need a cop, what are you going to do? What do you say to a person who says that to you?
I usually show them my firearm and say that, you know, I have this and many friends, family, and a good skill set, so I don't really have any interest in calling a cop. In fact, I have a funny story about that. A few days ago, earlier this week, my car got burglarized, and I might as well call the police to report it. And, you know, I knew nothing's going to come of it because this is not the first time this has happened. And the cop was very nice, I guess. You know, he wasn't as, well, anyway. So, yeah, he took a report and said, yeah, you're about the sixth or seventh person to call and tell us this. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, but they don't like, it's not like on TV. They don't dust for fingerprints. They don't look for footprints. Or, you know, they don't do any of that. They fill out a report and, you know, what was stolen, you know, approximately what's the value, blah, blah, blah. And I'll never hear anything from them. Yeah. I'm pretty much out the stuff that was stolen from me. In fact, I took the initiative myself. One of the things that was stolen was an old cell phone that I was using as an MP3 player for my podcast in the car. And I just decided to go around to all the pawn shops and cell phone shops around town and say, hey, look, you know, if anyone comes in with this particular phone, you can call the cops too if you really want, but I don't think they're going to do anything. But make sure you call me. So, yeah, I took the initiative myself.
And, you know, in the world we live in currently, we kind of have to report stuff like that for insurance purposes, if nothing else, you know, or to just cover yourself. It's not really because we want or expect their help. You know, and this is kind of, I'm kind of surprised because you don't really live in a big city or anything there, right? You live, you're more of a country person.
No, I am. I don't remember the exact population of the town I live in, Augusta. I'll check in a minute, but it's not very big. And I actually live on the outskirts of town. But, you know, it was kids, right, that did this.
Right.
I've always been a strong believer in karma, and this reaffirms my belief in karma, because when I was a young and foolish teenager, I did the you get what you give, right? So, I mean, granted, this has happened to me, though. I think this is the fourth time in 5 years, different locations in the city, but yeah. So I don't know, man, karma's a little out of whack, but it's definitely there. So be a good person. You know, golden rule, non-aggression principle and all that, and you don't have to worry about kids breaking your cars. At least I hope so.
Yeah, and you know, that's going to happen pretty much anywhere, and it's going to happen whether or not the police are there, because they certainly didn't stop it from happening. You know, they're not out patrolling the neighborhoods and preventing it. All they can do is fill out a form afterwards.
Well, I had this really neat fantasy, I guess you'd call it. Like, if I would have found these kids, I'm just such a horribly deep sleeper at times that it's no wonder I didn't hear them. And they were very sneaky and quiet because they didn't close the door completely. But anyway, if I would have heard the kids, I would have walked out very quietly out the back door and kind of stumbled upon them and clicked the old shotgun and said, okay, boys, why don't you stop what you're doing? And I would have, you know, told them to get on the ground and be very calm and cooperative. And I probably would have lectured them and said, you know, hey, I was young once. I did some stupid things, but I didn't have a really cool person with a shotgun trying to teach me right from wrong, you know? It took me getting busted and getting put on probation before I learned my lesson. So here's the deal. You fork over all the stuff you stolen. You go and vamoos. And I give you about 10 minutes, then I'll call the cops, turn in all the stolen gear so hopefully it can make its way back to its rightful owner. Mm-hmm. And you consider yourselves really lucky because you didn't get shot or arrested. Don't you think that would maybe influence a young mind to do the right thing more than just getting busted and thrown on probation or in juvie?
I think it would, you know. I really think it would. Because, you know, what are they going to learn in juvie anyway? is just how to do what they were doing with better efficiency.
Yeah, just like jail.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I got to say, too, like another story from my youth, my friend and I used to cut across this old dude's lawn, right, to go, I don't know, wherever we were going, school or whatever. And the guy used to totally come out and yell at us because, you know, it was his lawn. He didn't want kids crossing it. And that's cool, man. His property. Now I get it. You know, I get property rights now. I didn't at 13 years old. But we didn't listen. So one day he came out with a shotgun, and apparently he had a slug loaded with rock salt. I will tell you, I never cut across that man's yard again.
Did he clip with it?
Oh, he did. It was very painful. Getting shot with rock salt, not only does it cut and penetrate the skin, but once it gets in there, it melts and it stings like heck. So, yeah, I learned my lesson after that. No more.
Wow.
Yeah. I think I even gave the guy a Christmas card.
So this is the difference in country living and city living. You're not going to hear of that ever taking place in New York City. That would, you know, that would result in the guy with the shotgun getting mowed down by the police, you know, or even you even walk outside. I was living in Reno during the 90s, and there was an incident where a guy was in an apartment complex, and he heard somebody out in the parking lot messing with his car. So he just went out there to investigate, and they were stealing his tires off the car. And so he grabbed the tire iron that was laying on the ground there and went after the car thieves and actually confronted one of them and, I guess, you know, pinned him and so forth. And then there was great discussions as to whether or not the DA was going to file charges against the guy for defending his own car. It was crazy. So we got a slight dropout there. Chandler has stepped away for a second. Now Chandler's back. Okay.
Good. Yeah.
Go ahead,
Chandler. And you see that, I think you see it everywhere. I've even noticed it up here in Maine, right? Like the Castle Doctrine doesn't fully apply. I've talked about this on past shows. I think I did a show with Randy once and talked about it. You know, I went to a it wasn't just firearms. It was like a home protection class. My uncle put it on, and because he's a firearms instructor, and he had a lawyer come in. And, you know, there are certain criteria that you have to meet before you can confront an intruder, even in your own home. It's ridiculous. Like me, I've always said that if you're on my property and you have the intent to steal or harm me, I have the intent and the right to respond. Granted, that force will be proportionate. I may not shoot you if you're unarmed and you're just being a jerk.
Right.
But I do have a right to respond. And if you are armed and you are a threat, I do have the right to shoot you. And I shouldn't have to worry about reprisals from the DA or the local police. But
right.
Unfortunately, in this day and age, you see it.
Yeah, it's crazy. But even at that, it's still, I think it's still better to live, you know, out in, I cannot imagine what it would be like living in a city. You know, I haven't spent, since being an adult, I haven't spent very much time in cities. Reno was probably the biggest city, and we were even there on the very outskirts. There was literally open desert on three sides of where we lived, and there were Mustangs that would come up and eat out of the grass and stuff. So even when we were in Reno, that it really wasn't a city, like a, you know, a real city. But I just can't imagine living compacted in on people like that.
It's a shock to the system because when I was a freshman in high school, I moved down to Florida to live with my mom, and she lived in St. Petersburg. Now you got to understand, a Maine country boy, and I was a country boy like back then. Going down to St. Petersburg, Florida, which isn't like, you know, we're not talking New York City, but it's a city. It's sizable. There are slums and there are ghettos, and it's very racially diverse, which at the time when I was growing up, Maine wasn't. It was quite a shock to the system. It took a lot of adjustments, so much so that I only lasted a school year. And then I was like, all right, I love you, Ma, but I'm going back to Maine. You know, so it's, I can't see how people can do it. You know, I like that I can sit out here on my porch and look out in my backyard and see lots of trees and hear crickets and birds. You know, every morning I sit at my computer and write, and I always hear this one chirping bird come sits by my window. You know, I'm always hearing birds and crickets, and I like that. You know, it helps balance out the sound of traffic which, you know, kind of sucks, but at least I've got that balance, so.
Yeah, that's. I think that's one of the reasons that I like the lifestyle that my wife and I have now with living in the RV and, you know, moving around. And if we're in a campgrounds for a little too long, we just go to another campground. And we can pick and choose where we're at. The campgrounds that we're in right now, at nighttime, it's very dark. The only lights are down low, close to the ground, you know, paths and so forth. So
yeah.
You have a big, beautiful sky out there, and, you know, you can see the stars, assuming there's no clouds coming in off the Gulf. But you can see all the clouds, all the stars at night, and you can't see any of that stuff in a city. It's you know, just one big, invisible shield over your eyes with all the light that's coming out of a city.
Yeah. No, you guys got it right, man. That's true freedom right there. Long-time Fiend listeners know I'm a real big fan of Saul Williams, and I would suggest to any of you out there to Google or YouTube or Vimeo Saul Williams. He's excellent. But I was reading one of his books the other day, and I came across a poem that he wrote, and I really liked it. I ended up sharing it on Facebook, and, you know, it's fitting that we're talking about this now because it fits right in. So there's no title, but it starts thus. Intellect is like a major city, laden with concrete and metal, advanced modes of transportation, shining buildings, and fenced-in parks. Spirit is in the mountains, forest, wilderness, and vast countryside that surrounds it. Too many people live in the city, struggling day to day for mere existence. Most have forgotten how to live off the land. They only experience nature on class trips and short-term vacations. For those that live in the country, cities are like amusement parks with high prices and temporal satisfaction. At the end of the day, they are tired and ready to go home to relieve their ringing ears.
Wow.
Yeah, he's great. And it's so true.
Perfect.
So ponder that while we go to the market.
Listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Hey, this is Squiscar Squiggles from Death Clocks, and you are listening to the Freedom Fiends on the, you know, the radios. And I guess I says worms now, so there you go.
Tired of those old Freedom Fiends buttons? Well, the Freedom Fiends have new button designs.
As always, it's only $10 for 10 buttons, and you'll get these nifty designs. Buy sheep, for sheep, on sheep.
State speech is hate speech.
Two designs for Guns and Weed, the Road to Freedom.
Three designs for Fiend Phone.
Bipcot No Gov.
A Freedom Fiends Worms button.
And ask me about my worms.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says Buttons.
And now they're bigger buttons.
They used to be 1¼ inch. Now they're 1¾ inch. Dan, they're bigger buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
And to all my brothers and sisters in the South, it's Ka, not Car.
You know, there's a name for the speech impediment that doesn't allow the pronunciation of an R, and it's something like R-ism or something like that.
Meaner.
No, it is something like R-ism or R, it's one of those things where you think, well, how cruel is, because it's for people who specific, not that it's, that the R is not in their language, but they can't pronounce the R because of their mouth,
yeah.
Disability in their mouth. I'm butchering this story horribly, but the name of it is like R-ism or something. And it's like, why would you name it something that you know the person who has it can't pronounce it? You know, that's just cruel.
Yeah, that seems like kind of a jerk move, right?
Who was that twisted doctor?
Yeah, I have I-ism. I have I-ism. Yeah, that's just wrong.
That's mean. Oh, man. Yeah, so country living, city living, there's another thing that I think that, you know, immigration is a big thing always in the news and talking about it and everything like that. And I've never understood, being a type of a person who tends towards the country and having a lot of experience out in the West, and both in the Mountain West and the Desert West, and, you know, thinking of all that I've seen and all that I've traveled, there's so much open space that there's nothing on it. You get into, you know, out west in Nevada and Arizona and New Mexico, large portions of California, and you can literally drive for hours and not see a house of any kind, a building, nothing, just nothing but desert or plains or prairies, and just go and go and go. And I've never really understood the argument against immigration when they say, well, we don't have room for all these immigrants, or we don't have, and really, I've in thinking about, and recently, Hans Hermann Hoppe, years ago, Hans Hermann Hoppe came out with a thing about immigration, and a lot of people jumped behind it and they liked it, and some people didn't like it, and they, Walter Block wrote a critique of it, and several other people have written contrary opinions of it. And then recently it's come back up again. It comes back up again every few months. Somebody, some libertarian, will quote Hoppe on it and justify their hatred of immigration based on Hoppe's words. And I've tried to wrap my mind around, why is it that these libertarians that agree with Hoppe on this, what is it that they are so afraid of? Or what is it that why are they so against immigration? And I've boiled it down to a couple things. I think there's a fear of scarcity of land, a fear of scarcity of jobs, a fear of scarcity of housing. There's a fear of cultural shift. There's a fear of language shift, and there's a fear of racial mixing. And as much as I think about it, I can't figure out where anyone's objections are other than in those things. And those are all based on fear. And as you look at them, is there a scarcity of land? No, there's not. You could fit everybody, you know, in like one county in California, you could give almost everybody almost an acre in San Bernardino County. Not quite. I didn't do the math on that. I'm just throwing out numbers. But, you know, there's plenty of space, and there's plenty of unused land. So there is no scarcity of land, scarcity of jobs. Well, an economy creates jobs according to how many more people are in it. So the more immigrants you have in, and the United States in the 1800s is an example of this, the more immigrants that come in, the more jobs it creates. It doesn't take away jobs. An economist of all people in the world, an Austrian economist, should know that. The more people, the more jobs. And the same thing with housing. It doesn't create a scarcity of housing. It creates a market to build more housing, which creates more jobs. And so what are we really talking about? We're talking about a fear of a cultural shift, a fear of a language shift, and a fear of racial mixing. Now we're getting down to the brass tacks of what these people are really afraid of. And I think if they were honest, that's what they would talk about. They would talk about their fear of a cultural shift, their fear of a language shift, and their fear of racial mixing. And I don't know how... Oh, go ahead. I've rambled on long enough. Go ahead, Chandler.
No, finish your thought first.
Well, I was just going to take a jab at Hoppe because he's an immigrant.
Well, there, yeah. I guess I understand the fear. Well, just ponder on fear for a minute and what motivates you. And when we get back from the market, I'll elaborate that with an example from Maine.
And I'll try to keep my mouth shut and let Chandler talk too, folks.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
Are you sick of peaceful people being locked away for victimless crimes? Instead of trying to get out of jury duty, consider taking it so you can do the right thing. A single juror with a conscience can send someone home to their family instead of to a jail cell. If there's no victim, how can there be a crime? And if the judge or prosecutor are keeping you in the dark, what are they trying to hide? You can vote your conscience instead of being a pawn of the state. For more information, Google jury nullification or check out the Fully Informed Jury Association at fija.org.
The Central Scrutinizer is a Soviet-style Leviathan trying to keep track of all you do. That's why I use a VPN or virtual private network from Bola VPN. Bola VPN is inexpensive, secure, and will allow you to use your computer without leaving a trail. Bola VPN is now also offering torrent seed boxes for safely sharing media with the world. And if you open a support ticket saying you heard about them from the Freedom Fiends, they'll add 3 extra days free. That's Bola VPN at BOLEHVPN.net.
So we were talking about fear and racial shifting, racial mixing, cultural shifts, language shifts. And you had a story on that, Chandler. Are you back, Chandler?
Yeah, I lost you for a minute there.
Yeah, dropped out for a second. So you had a story on that, on the
fear. Yeah, so in, I believe it was 2001 or 2002, there was an influx of Somali people into Lewiston, Maine. And if I remember correctly, at first there was a, I don't know if it was just the mayor or, you know, the town, the, you know, whoever runs the town. I don't know. I don't pay attention to that stuff. But, you know, they encouraged this open immigration and everything. And there was a lot of blowback. A lot of people were afraid of, like you said, the cultural shift. And they're called The Letter, An American Town and the Somali Invasion. And the plot of the documentary, I'm just reading from Wikipedia, you can look it up on that. In October 2002, former mayor of Lewiston, Laurier T. Raymond, wrote an open letter addressed to the leaders of the Somali immigrant community, predicting a negative impact on the city's social services and requesting that they discourage further relocation to the town. The letter angered some persons and prompted various community leaders and residents to speak out against the mayor, drawing national attention. Demonstrations were held in Lewiston by both those who supported the immigrants' presence and those who opposed it. In January 2003, a small white supremacist group demonstrated in the city in support of the mayor, prompting a simultaneous counter-demonstration of about 4,000 people at Bates College and the organization of the Many in One Coalition. So it's an interesting documentary to watch, but the whole issue, I think, like I said, it evolved from fear, from the worry that the cultural shift was going to be too much, and then, you know, housing. There's not enough housing, and all those immigrants are using our tax dollars to be welfare kings and queens, and which really isn't true. I mean, of course you're going to see some of that in I don't think it's necessarily because they were immigrants. I think it was because that part of Lewiston that they immigrated to is a poorer part of the town. In fact, the whole town has kind of gone downhill. You see plenty of white people on welfare over there too. So I don't think you can pin it on any one social group. I think it's more of an economic thing. And you know, we know the cycle of welfare. It discourages independence and growth and helps kind of lock you in that state. So It's really unfortunate that people let those fears get a hold of them and get the better of them. But it's a fact of life. I mean, like you said before, immigration, this country was founded on immigration and really drove some of the economic prosperity we saw in the 1800s. And when you talk about there's not enough room for these immigrants, well, All I can say is maybe if the government didn't own and control 75% of the land in this country, I don't think you'd be able to make that argument.
Yeah, that's a really good point. In some places, like out in Nevada, between the state and the federal government, they own something like 98% of the land in Nevada. And, yeah, you know, it's similar throughout Wyoming, Montana, you know, Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico. Through that whole area, Idaho, the government holds vast tracts of land, and they won't let go of it. It's not like in the 1800s when you could go homestead it. All of those laws are changed now. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you see it even in Maine. Like, if you've ever been to northern Maine, it's not populated. It's paradise, right? It's so sparsely populated, and there's such beautiful wilderness up there, a lot of resources. But, you know, they had like Loring Air Force Base, and if you follow some of the theorists, but the people that like to talk about conspiracies, they say there's FEMA camps and all that stuff up there. I don't know, but there's a lot of fenced off land that the government just doesn't allow you to trespass on. Like, you can't go hiking in certain areas. You can't go canoeing or fishing in certain areas. There's a huge chunk of that up north. I mean, if they did away with that, and if they turned the old Air Force Base into some sort of like residential area, I don't see how you could make an argument about room for immigrants, that's for sure.
Where I used to live in California, in the Mojave Desert, during the 60s and then more so in the 70s and then even well up into the 80s, there was a lot of people escaping, trying to get away from Southern California, from the, you know, the L.A. Basin and all the mess that's down there in that whole area, and all the people and the pollution and the noise and the lights and everything. And also there was a little bit of a back to nature movement in the late 70s and early 80s. And so there was a lot of people that just went out into the Mojave Desert. And, you know, there's places in the Mojave Desert where there are natural springs that crop up. And the spring will come right out of a side of a mountain, and it'll only flow for 15, 20 feet, and then it'll disappear into the desert floor. So unless you know where it's at, you don't know where it's at. But there are people who have gone around, and I used to find those all the time when I used to have a dune buggy, and I'd take my motorcycle and drive around in the desert. So I'd find them all the time. But there's people coming up out of the cities that would either build shanty houses, or they would move a trailer house out there or something, a motorhome or something, and they would find one of those springs, or they would get to a spot where the county supplies water or whatever, or some of them even had wells professionally dug or, you know, drilled. But they would get out there into the middle of the desert, and they would squat on land that was BLM controlled land, Bureau of Land Management. And you'd see these little squatter spots all over. Now, when I say see, there's not so many of them that you would notice until you were right on top of them, because there's proportionate to the amount of land in the Mojave Desert, there's almost none of these people out there. But they are there, and if you know where to look, you can find them. And most of them are pretty friendly, but they like to be left alone, and they don't like to have inspectors come out and tell them how they have to build their roof. And they don't like to have inspectors coming out and tell them how they have to do everything. And so they're technically they're living out there illegally. Well, after 2001, after, you know, the September 11th of 2001, the counties and the cities in Southern California, for some reason or another, became energized to go out there and hassle those people. And so what we've seen over the last 15 years or so is a systematic attack on these people by the city dwellers, because how dare you go out there in the desert where, you know, and leave everybody alone? How dare you go out there and want us to leave you alone? You can't live out there in, you know, by your own will and the way you want to live and with solar panels. And, you know, you have to come, we have to bulldoze that place down that you built and force you to become homeless and live in the city. I mean, that's essentially, you know, the product of what they did to those people. It's really horrible. And I don't know why people in a city are so, why they have such an obsession with wanting to destroy something like that, where people are out there, you know, not bothering anybody at all.
Well, I think it's, honestly, I think part of it is jealousy, because a lot of those people probably couldn't do that themselves, and they're jealous and envious that people are out there basically living free, right? If normal code and they're living free, it doesn't matter that they're nonviolent and they're not hurting anyone. They're not following the system. They're not being good team players, right? Because everything nowadays is about the collective. Have you noticed that?
Yeah. I mean,
the more and more I interact with people, it's, well, we need to do this for the good of. And it's like, really? Really? Okay. So I mean, that's why I don't leave my house very much anymore. I think that's a big part of it, you know, because these people refuse to be part of the collective and they want to do their own thing. And again, I mean, that's a threat to the established systems, because if these people are successful and other people notice that, don't you think that's going to give some bolder people incentive to go out there and follow their example?
You know, this takes us back to what we were talking about in the first hour with Ross Ulbricht. And the fact that the judge in the sentencing Ross with two life sentences plus for running a website. I mean, it's just crazy. Again, I don't want to go off and harp on that for an hour, but it's crazy that the judge would sentence Ross to two lifetimes plus for no violent, there was no violence involved in any of the charges that he was found guilty of. And yet, you know, he's got two life sentences. But the judge, she said in her sentencing statement that he had dangerous ideas and that she was going to use him as an example. And she said this stuff in her statement. So it is echoing exactly what we're talking about. Why do those people in the city, why can't they leave those people alone out there in the desert to just live their own lives peaceably, leaving other people alone? Why do they have to go out there and mess with them? And the reason why is because their freedom is a threat to the slaves. Because if enough slaves figure it out, hey, we don't have to do this. Hey, we can just do what we want. We're not hurting anybody. We can go make our own website, and we can figure out a way to buy and sell things on the internet without the government's permission. Let's just do it. And that is a massive threat to the nannies of the world and to the slaves that enjoy their slavery and are jealous of anybody else who doesn't, you know, that's not wearing the chains, who refuses to wear the chains.
Well, I had this discussion, the place that I pick up one of my clients, it's a facility, and I was talking with the staff members there, and we were talking about my I get them confused because I have so many of them. But I have to go to court, right? And so I went for the non-registration thing. And, you know, I made the point that, like, I'm not going to register the car. I'm not going to get a gun permit. You know, I'm not going to get a fishing. Like, the fishing and hunting license was my big one. I got really irate when they suggested I should at least do that, right? And, you know, I'd be on a mildly intellectual level. But they're like, but, you know, we can't do that because. And I'm like, okay. See, that's where the problem is. You say we can't do that because, and you've got a reason. We've all got reasons. But what happens if you just don't say that anymore? What happens if you and you and you and you, y'all just say, yeah, you know what? I'm not going to get that license, or I'm not going to get that piece of paper that says I can do something, or, you know, whatever the situation is. Once people stop complying, stop being afraid and complying with the system, that's when you start to see change, right? So Ross, He did something revolutionary. He did something innovative, and he paid the price, right? And your activism, you may pay the price, but you might also inspire others to follow suit. And that's something to think about.
It's catchy. It's addictive.
Listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
Do
fiends. We are fiends for freedom. We are addicted to the thought of freedom. We can't get enough. We will alter our lives to get more freedom, to get free, to be free. You just can't get enough of it. It's like it gets into your brain, the desire for freedom, and you just can no longer tolerate the chains. That's why I can't.
Yeah, and
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and that may sound kind of like silly or exaggerated, but it's really the truth. I mean, once you experience it, it's intoxicating, and you want to do more and more. You know, you let that rebellious spirit flow through you, and you just want to keep going. Man's natural state is free, I think.
When I was a teenager, my dad had a construction company, and among the other things that he did, he was a pretty amazing guy. But anyway, one of the things he had was a construction company, and I would work for him on and off at times. And we, back in the Mojave Desert, we dug into a burrow of owls. These little owls that live in the Mojave Desert are burrowing owls. They go down and dig into the ground, and rather than nesting up in trees or whatever, they nest under the ground. It's really cool. And they're really small owls. So we inadvertently disturbed the nest and messed everything all up, and I ended up rescuing one of the little baby owls out of it. And I brought him home. Here's the choice. You can stomp on the poor little thing, you know, or you can or try to at least give him a life, right? So I took him home, and I kept him warm the first night, and by the next morning I was feeding him. Like, I didn't know what to give him. I knew he's a meat eater, but so I'm giving him like bologna and stuff, and I'm thinking, well, this has got to be bad for him with all the salt in it and everything. So I got my shotgun, went outside, shot a couple Tweety birds, carefully picked all the, you know, all the pellets out of them, all the shot out of the little birds, and brought them in and just let him really just savage, you know, the little whatever kind of Tweety birds that I could shoot. And so I started hand feeding this little baby owl, and he took to it right away, you know, and grew really fast. And I had him in the house in a good sized cage, but I had him in the cage because I didn't want him just flying around the house. He'd end up getting hurt. And I didn't want him outside because there's coyotes and junk out there in the desert. So for his own safety, I kept him in the house in a cage. But then more and more, I would open the cage door and let him out during the day and just make sure that he was back in the cage at night. And eventually, I'm opening the window and I'm taking him out on the porch. And very quickly, when I started taking him out on the porch, very quickly, he figured out that it was much better out on the porch than it is inside the house in that cage. And it was only, you know, a matter of a couple days until he didn't come back in at all anymore. Now, he was still friendly with me. He would fly up on the porch and sit there and make noises at me. He had like a chirping sound, and I would chirp back at him. But he would not voluntarily come back in through that window and into the cage. And I think that's it. You know, it's that spirit that is inside of all of us that really, once you figure out, this is how I'm supposed to live, I'm supposed to be free, and then you just don't want to go back to that cage anymore. It doesn't matter how nice things are, how protected you are, or how you're fed, or any, none of that matters. Freedom is so much better.
Yeah, it's instinct, and it doesn't matter, like you said, how big the cage is. Once you see the cage,
yeah,
that's all you want to do is get out.
I think that's it. And I think the fear of seeing the cage is why, you know, if you talk to somebody on Facebook, or I'm not on Facebook, but if you talk to somebody like that in social media and you see them all of a sudden really bring out an illogical level of anger that you're talking to them about freedom. And you have to wonder, like, why are you upset about that? Why are you angry? And the root cause is because they don't want to see that cage. They're terrified of the thought of knowing about the cage, because then they've got to do something about it.
Well, then you have to be an individual and take responsibility for yourself and your actions. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that you know, statists don't do that, but there's a certain amount of security living under the system. And once you escape that, you know, you've got true freedom, for better or worse. So make the most of it.
Henry David Thoreau said something to the effect of, I would rather sit by myself on a pumpkin in a field than on a silk cushion crowded with people. Now, that's my,
yep.
You know, I'm twisting his words slightly, but that's basically what he said.
I remember that one. He's great. Yeah, go out and read Walden, Civil Disobedience. Good stuff. It was great talking to you, Ben.
Great talking to you, Chandler. Thanks a ton for coming on the show with me.
Thanks for having me. And you folks take care out there.